Listen up. I hate to have commercials interrupt this interview, so I'm going to tell you about three sponsors quickly now, and then we're going to go right into the program, starting with Walker Corporate Law. If you need a lawyer who understands the startup world and the tech community, I want you to go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, I want to tell you about Shopify. When your friend asks you, "How can I sell something online?" I want you to send them to Shopify and explain to them that Shopify stores are easy to set up. They increase sales and they'll make your friends' products look great. Shopify. Finally, I want to tell you about Grasshopper. Do you want a phone number that people can call and then press one for sales, two for tech support, etc., and have all of the calls be routed to the right person's cell phone? Well, get your number from grasshopper.com. All right, let's get started. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. What happens when an entrepreneur sets out to build a billion-dollar business? Arid Trasdal is the founder of Tapad, an ad technology firm that offers cross-device advertising solutions. When he started out his business, he didn't want to think small. I invited him here to talk about how he built this company up. Arid, welcome.
Thank you.
I've heard you say that when you were trying to figure out what business to get into, the room that you were working in made you look like a mad scientist. Anyone who would have seen it. Why did you use that description?
I was working on a lot of different ideas. I was kind of fortunate after my last company to be able to take some extended time period of time off. But then after a while, I was really excited about getting back and starting another company again. So I had a war room in the house with then 26 different business ideas. So every time I had more ideas around one of these ideas, I would write it down on these huge post-it notes or these huge flipovers, and they would have lines going from one to the other, and it looked like like a mad scientist this room. So that was exciting. It's a very exciting process. Starting a company is kind of half logic and half magic. So the logic part of that was just kind of getting done tons of research done and starting to put it up on the wall so that you could make sense of it all.
I want to break down that process and make sense of it all, because in a short period of time, you did incredibly well. How old's the company and what size revenue are you guys doing now?
Yeah, we started building it in 2010, end of 2010. It took us a year to build it. So we launched it in end of 2011. And after we launched it, it's gone from zero in revenue to now we're hitting a $40 million run rate in revenue. So it's been seeing some tremendous growth, but there was a lot of periods there that was pretty tough. But after we really got the solution out in market, and it has taken off like nothing I've seen before.
I've written a note here to come back and ask you about those tough periods because I want to hear them too. But since I started out asking you about this mad scientist approach to coming up with your idea, let me understand, what did you put up on the wall? Were you putting up your vision for the wall, for the world, up on those post-it notes, or were you putting up business ideas that you'd like to pursue? What were in those post-it notes?
You know, it's a good, very good question. It was actually a little bit of both. One was you had to have this kind of unified view of where the world was going. You had to kind of what are consumers doing? What is all these kind of technologies that are happening now with the smartphones and the tablets and the screens everywhere? And what does that really mean for a consumer? And in order to understand technology, you really need to understand what is it that makes sense. So that was the kind of the overarching portion of it. But then that broke down then into these, when it gets a little bit less scientific, it broke down into all of these 26 different ideas that could be from a shoeshine company to like a cross-device, multi-device advertising technology company, which we ended up buying. But they had a lot of kind of commonalities to them, and started kind of applying filters to it as well. So you were really looking at the ways that you can build these huge businesses.
I see. So where most people would say, "Hey, what's exciting right now?" and they look down at their phone and say, "Okay, this is what's exciting. I love my phone." You'd say, "Wait, where's the world going 5 years from now and beyond? And then what will those opportunities be at that point?" And that's the kind of view that you were taking.
It is, yeah, and that's really when we came up with this kind of this solution for what that we ended up building for Tapad as well, was that it wasn't about all these point solutions. It wasn't about a Groupon for mobile. It wasn't about like a bunch of things that happened online for mobile. Because 3 years ago, that was what most of the innovation was around, taking things that have worked on other platforms and making them work on mobile. And that wasn't really innovation. And I didn't believe that the world was going to go in that direction. And now we have.
Why wasn't it enough to say, hey, everyone's going to have mobile devices in the future, iPhones, iPads, Samsung, et cetera. All I'm going to do is take what worked on the desktop and move it to mobile. Why wasn't that big enough?
No, I think because Groupon is going to be the Groupon on mobile. I think the ones that already have this, it doesn't make any sense for them. In order to build a company, you also have to understand what are all the competitors going to do. So if you just have a solution that's X for mobile, then you run into these problems of day on the X is going to go come and kill you.
So the
process was all about, but this kind of brought us to this. We started to understand that consumers are jumping between screens. You're on your phone in 1 minute, and the next minute you are on your tablet, and then you are on your computer, and then you are in front of your television at the same time. And this really happened through this kind of mad scientist process, was to that it's not so much about the actual screen or the platform itself, it's about this particular consumer that's living in this multi-screen world. And how does that influence advertising and content and commerce and everything? So that was kind of this, to your earlier questions, what was kind of on the wall there, that came one of these like big themes that we later developed and the Tapad idea out of.
And part of that process was, as you started saying, and I interrupted, was the filters. What were the three filters that you used to figure out which of those ideas were worth pursuing?
Yeah, it's after a while, I was going to the beach in the meantime here as well, and my wife wanted me out of the house, I think. So she said, all right, we got to actually pick one of these ideas, pick any idea. So then I started applying three filters to it. One was it needed to be scalable, so a business that can build, can become a billion-dollar business. Not that we necessarily can and want to build a billion-dollar business, but it has the potential of becoming a billion-dollar business. Number two, that as it scales, it's a protectable business, so that you can protect it and you're pulling the ladder up behind you as you're building this business. And number three, that this is actually a profitable business. So there's so many of these kind of ideas that can be interesting, but there's just no potential of creating a billion-dollar profitable and very protectable business. So
was there a second best idea that met all those qualifications, but you decided not to pursue?
There was. We had actually, when we started Tapad, we started. I couldn't make up my mind. So there was another idea as well that was 3 years ago. It wasn't much kind of richer media and video and these type of things on mobile devices. But then when we got the tech team together, it took us 2 weekends to build this thing. So I thought, this is not a hard enough problem to solve. So because of that, we said that let's go for this multi-screen cross platform solution that seems absolutely impossible to solve because you had all these problems with it, so it seems absolutely impossible to solve. But I knew that if we solved it, there were very few people that were going to be able to do the same thing. And it was also in an advertising market, so $300 billion market. So you can easily build a billion-dollar business there as long as you can protect it and have it be profitable.
I see. The idea that you scrapped was for advertising that was with premium video. So not just static images, not text the way that Google popularized, but premium video. And you said, if I could build it this quickly, anyone else could. They could come in and compete with us.
Yeah, exactly. So it didn't hit the criterion number two. It's just very scalable, very profitable, but it's not protectable. So then we looked for these things that were much harder to solve, things that are incredibly difficult to solve, but we can't solve it. And we spent a year trying to solve it. We still couldn't solve it until we really broke through and solved it. And I knew that we had something that we could, that was very hard for others to do.
And one of the things that you did after that, as I understand from your pre-interview with Jeremy Weiss, is that you talked to David Rosenblatt, the CEO of DoubleClick, right? Once you had this vision, why did you talk to him?
Well, I think that innovation doesn't happen in a vacuum. I don't think any founder is so smart and brilliant that they can just be in their mad scientist room and come up with something that's fabulous. That one, you have to get out of that room and sit down with people that have done it before. And he obviously built a multi-billion dollar company and sold it to Google for $3-4 billion. So I was lucky to have a lot of friends like that in my immediate circle of friends. So I was kind of sitting down with a lot of them to get their input on this idea then. So at that point, the idea would probably be like 60-70% developed. I think a lot of entrepreneurs are at that point afraid of discussing this because they are afraid that the idea is going to just go out to everybody so that they can do it. But I sat down with David and another like 10 guys like him, or a few people that are like him, but 10 in that kind of same type of person, and then we just started really discussing it and getting feedback from somebody who knew this incredibly well, that was one, to verify that this idea that I had was actually made sense, and number two, to get their input on how you thought about this, how about this, you should meet that person. And this was what my experience in building a multi-billion dollar company was. We had these problems, and all, getting all of that input early was very helpful for the company.
So I'm still, I've done a lot of reading on this company, and I've got your website up on my screen here, tapad.com. But I want to understand what the vision was in the beginning, and I think maybe the best way to understand it is with the use case. Can you give me an example of how you envision someone interacting with this technology that would work cross-platform?
Yeah, in the beginning, what we really saw was that targeting and analytics on mobile. So my last company was one of the biggest buyers of mobile advertising in the U.S.
This is Thumbplay, and you guys did a lot of ringtones.
Yeah, music and games, videos for mobile devices. We were 60% at one point of AdMob's revenue that later got sold to Google. But really, what this first generation of advertising plays on mobile were not incredibly data-driven, and they were also these kind of point solutions. So we were looking at finding a way to target these ads much more efficiently. So starting out with a huge group of people, you want to start out with a smaller group of people that have a higher probability of actually buying a product. So that was what we innovated around in the beginning.
Target a small group of people and do it no matter where they are.
Exactly. And we saw that I saw it on my, when I was thinking about advertising solutions, I tried to look at my own, remove myself from the technology and look at myself as a consumer and all the consumers around me. And the thing that I saw was consumers are not on one device in a long period of time. People are, especially when in the middle of this, the iPad came out as well. And I would see that people were on these multiple devices throughout the entire day, and just having a point solution, siloed solution for mobile over on this end, no matter how smart and good you are in your technology for that, you just missed the entire picture. So,
meaning AdMob would only advertise to me when I was on my iPhone, but not when I was at work on my computer.
Exactly. Yeah. So they would lose so much as you were switching between screens. These underlying technologies didn't switch between screens at all. So I started kind of diving in and trying to understand why that was so. And the whole industry had kind of grown up, and every time there's a new platform come out, then there's a new team that's doing that, and it creates this very fragmented approach to media.
And if you think the idea that you don't just want to advertise both on mobile and on computer screen and other screens too, but you want to know that I saw an ad when I was on my mobile device, and then when I switch to my desktop, you want to know I'm the same person, and either show me an ad again that reinforces the message, or don't show me anything if you've decided that I'm not the right person, but identify me at least as that customer.
That is exactly right. Yeah, you should work on the marketing side of
it. I've done a lot of work. Actually, you know what? TechCrunch did a really good piece that helped me understand this, where they were talking about your retargeting campaign, and that's when it started to click for me.
Yeah, no, it is, and it's big. It's, and I've always been this biggest problem in advertising is that I know that 50% of my ads work, I just don't know what 50%. And that's even before digital, is that you had your print, you had your television, you had your radio, but these channels didn't really work together, and you didn't know how your print buy influenced your television and how that influenced, eventually influenced products that got purchased in a store. So it was always been the biggest holy grail and the biggest problem in advertising is to solve this issue.
I'm going to continue with the narrative here, but I've got to ask one other question about this decision-making process. Yeah. Actually, two. The first is, one of your criteria was that it could be protectable. But if Google is buying mobile ad companies, then it has the whole picture. And if they did it, then other people could do the same thing. So doesn't that defeat the big filter that you wanted to apply to your business?
So if you're going to be in advertising, first you've decided that you want to be in advertising, you are up against some pretty big companies like Google. But a lot of these companies have, I wouldn't say stopped innovating, but they are innovating through acquisitions more than innovating through kind of internally or organically developed ideas. But even for a huge company like Google, you still see that they have these point solutions. They have an online solution, they have a mobile solution, they have a tablet solution, they have a television solution. So for us, it was not about kind of creating a better mousetrap on mobile. It was about kind of taking a completely different view of the world and starting from the top, which is starting with being able to reach this particular consumer, and no matter what platform they are on, in an integrated, holistic way. So I knew that I was going to run into competitors, but at the same time, I also knew that the competitors kind of outside of the Google ad system on the Google side are really not so strong on technology, and they have ad tech in their name. So I knew that behind the curtain on a bunch of these companies, there were actually not that great of engineering teams. So it was interesting to kind of build something that's truly technology and data and product driven and have zero salespeople. And then once we have that correct, then staff up on the sales side. A lot of people do the other way, start with the marketing, a bunch of PR and marketing, and then they hire the salespeople, and then they hire the product people, and then eventually they end up actually building the technology, but we did it the other way around.
Okay, and the second question about this portion of the development of the idea is, you talked to David of DoubleClick. How did he change your idea for this business?
Yeah, he is a pretty remarkable guy. So I gave him two options. Should we do build like a mobile exchange, which is something that happened online, and there's some kind of online ad exchanges, or should we build this cross-screen ability to re-engage with consumers? And he spent 2 seconds thinking, and I said, you should build cross-screen. And once you have that figured out, there's a lot of other businesses you can build. But I know, but he said also, I know there's a bunch of other companies who are trying to go after this exchange idea. What you're pitching me, well, the other thing is completely unique. I've never heard it before. It's the biggest problem you can solve. It's the absolute hardest thing you can do. We're working 80 to 100 hour weeks, and not doesn't care. So I said, oh, that sounds very tempting. So let's go down that path so that's good to have people like that and have others similar to him around me as well that could kind of help give this strategic advice throughout the building of the company.
I see. And again, according to that TechCrunch article that I read, he was part of the $1.8 million round that helped get the company going. So he was an advisor, but also an investor.
Yeah, so that's what ended up happening. I ended up sitting down with him and a lot of people that have built companies in the space, and asked just for their advice. And with their advice, said, okay, I now think that you're on something huge here. Can I also be a part of investing in your company? So we ended up not taking any venture money in the beginning, just a little piece from one VC, which was great. And then the rest was primarily these people that can help the company. That was the only thing I needed. I didn't need the money. I needed help to kind of shape this.
And the way that you actually launched it, I think, is really interesting, how small you kept it and what you did until you got to, until you decided to buy. But you mentioned something that I have to talk about before we get to what you launched with, your wife. The hours, I think you mentioned your wife, or maybe you mentioned the hours, and I connected it with what you said to Jeremy about your wife. She was pregnant. You were working 80 hours for 15 years, you said. Most of the entrepreneurs who I talk to, it seems to me sometimes, started out when they were 20 years old, didn't have wife or kids, didn't have any other obligations. All they had to do was work on their startup and eat pizza and then go back and work on their startup. you've got a wife and a baby on the way. How does it influence what you do?
I had luck there. I had like many of these 15 years. I was also in this, didn't have a wife, so I could.
So you had your pizza work.
Exactly.
Maybe not exactly pizza, but yeah.
So I was kind of lucky with my last company that I was able to kind of get out of that in a positive way. And right then we found that she was pregnant. So she was going to give birth right when I left there. So then actually the first year and a half, when I did all of these IDs up on the wall, I had a newborn baby. And that was just, I worked maybe 2 or 3 hours a day on this, because when you're in that phase, you're thinking as much about this as when you're on the beach or you're hanging out with your family as when you're in front of kind of actually working. But so the harder thing set in later than when I started this company, and then I'm back to like working 80-hour weeks again. So then that was a much kind of tougher period for
and
the
you
family.
Didn't scale it back. So how do you make a relationship work when you have to work 80 hours a week to bring this new idea to life?
No, she's an entrepreneur as well, so she has the understanding, and she's fabulous. So we also like to discuss all of these things with her and include her in everything that I'm doing and building, and the highs and the lows and all of that. So she understands. So she's fabulous. So I'm very very lucky.
I'll say. So what I was bringing up earlier is you said that you wanted to keep the whole company really small, not get a lot of people on board, not get a lot of money on board and really blow it up until you built something small scale. You had only 5 people at that period. What were you trying to build to prove out this idea?
Yeah, so we were really want to prove out that this worked. So in advertising, there's a bunch of smoke and mirrors, and a lot of people going out for martini lunches still, and it's 2013. So there's a lot of madmen days are at the end of the days, but there's still a lot of things in advertising. There's a lot of smoke and mirrors. I wanted to figure out that this actually did work, that we actually solved this big problem for the advertisers. And when you're doing that, you need to do a lot of testing back and forth. You need to get custom, and you need to be with a very tight, small team in the beginning to do that. So it's almost like Monster, no, what's that television show? Mythbusters, sorry. When you're building like a small prototype of this first, you don't go out and blow up a bunch of trailers.
Yeah, Mythbusters doesn't, right, they start out blowing small stuff up.
You have to build a little
so prototype. What's the small version that you build to validate the big idea?
Yeah, the small version was an end-to-end solution for everything that we were going to do later, and it was basically this concept of taking data from one platform, from computer, and using that data for targeting in mobile. And
I see, to know that I am on the computer and then understand that it's still me when I'm on my iPhone.
Yeah, and so prove that through actually running live campaigns for live advertisers on one platform, and see that when we applied our methodology versus not applied our methodology, that we drove 200-400% better results. And that was what we were able to do actually when we had built this. We came and said that, hey, this actually be driving this 250-300% improvement, even if the algorithms didn't work completely, didn't work as well as they do now in the beginning. When you drive that type of difference in results, you know that, oh shit, I'm onto something big here. Then at that point we started on say, okay, now we got to run as fast as possible here and make sure that we are the only ones in town with this solution. So.
And so you already sold it to an advertiser, you already built a prototype of it, and you said, we can increase this advertiser's results. Who did you get that was willing to experiment like this? What kind of advertiser?
Well, it was actually one of our investors. He had owned a, they had a, so that's, and they were, one of them was, it was Thrillist, actually, you know, the company Thrillist?
Yes.
Ben, he's also an investor in it. So you go to your friends and twist their arm until they sign up for the service. And very kind of small scale at that point, but we were able to actually prove that this this works. We looked at all the numbers and it proved that it works. And that
isn't Ben's father's company also an investor in the business?
They are, yeah. So I mean, Larry Ventures is an investor. Yep. They were also one of the ones that we really wanted to have a part of this in the beginning. So they were they came in very early together with David.
Okay, so now you're testing this out. You do need a developer, and this is one person who I want to talk about. How you got your head of technology? Can you tell the audience how you did that?
Yeah, so he had I'm Norwegian, and he's actually also Norwegian, and he had never been to the U.S. before, but he had this fabulous reputation in the country, and so I brought him over in the middle of these 26 IDs on the wall to work on a different ID than Tapad, which was kind of a communication text and phone type of solution. While I was whiteboarding up and creating more mess up on the wall, I thought he was kind of just taking notes, and he was actually sitting there and building the whole thing, the whole technology.
Oh, really?
In a week he had built a lot of this, and he then went back to Norway and put the final touches on it, and the product was in an alpha stage. So at that point, I said, okay, this guy is, I need this guy here. So then I brought him over, got him a girlfriend. And
did you say you got him a girlfriend?
And
I think you did, but okay.
And he was off to the races.
You had 300 meetings in a month and a lot of rejections?
In the beginning, so when we kind of had this breakthrough that this actually worked, we thought we have our... had saved the world of advertising, and we know it's just gonna, orders are gonna flow in. So then we started taking this out to the big brands. And at that point, we probably did 250, 300 meetings a month for 10, 12 months. And so what is that? 2,000-3,000 meetings with 2,000-3,000 rejections. We nobody wanted this. Nobody
Why?
Bought.
What were you learning that they were telling you no?
The thing was that it was more of this kind of a structural, systematic issue of how teams were organized, because you had a buying team for mobile, you had a buying team for tablets, you had a buying team for TV, and a buying team for computers, and they were running their own kind of little teams inside of these organizations, and nobody was responsible for multi-screen or cross-platform.
I see.
So they said, oh, I love this, it's definitely the future of advertising, but that's not how we are set up to as an organization. So the brands were not set up like that, and the agencies were not set up like that. So that has later changed in a big way, but back then it was this kind of systematic issue. I remember I had a lunch with one of the top executives at one of the agencies, and he probably saw that I was kind of all depressed and not excited, and he said, the way that you, and Tapad has made us completely rethink our entire agency, how we organize, how we measure, how we buy media. And I thought, but why have you not bought $1 of advertising from us? And he said, you have to understand that these are huge organizations that kind of need to move where the world is moving and take some time. So that was a very tough period when we were out there with the solution and we thought we had kind of saved it, and then we saving the world, the advertising world, and they just told us no.
But you're not the kind of person to go out and talk 1,000 times, hear no 1,000 times, and go out 1,001 times. You would have adjusted either your pitch or your product so that you could at least have a better shot at each time after each no. How did you adjust it over that period?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So we ended up actually adjusting it so that it fit more into and make it simpler, basically, instead of this huge holistic ID. We broke it down to, okay, this is how it works for mobile. You can still use your mobile budget and buy it, but we're just gonna take and optimize that based upon data that we have from other platforms.
Instead of saying, give me everything, you said, okay, give me just your mobile then, but understand that I will make this better than other mobile because I will inform your campaign by what people are doing online, on the computer.
Exactly, yeah. So then it fit into their structure. But what, and then actually I think we also were kind of instrumental in helping our customers change as well, because then they came back and said, hey, you can do this for mobile, can you do this for online, can you kind of do it all the other way around? So then they ended up kind of, and now we actually seen that a lot of these big brands and the big agencies have collapsed all these teams together into one team. So it was kind of a process where we had to adjust our approach to that. We can't just have this one big vision and just not listen to what people are saying, and we had to adjust it. But now we're back up on where we started with the vision.
I see. And that's the Trojan horse that got you into people's offices, that you said, we will sell you mobile. And then once they started buying that, everything else was possible.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Okay. And then which is the big customer that got you really rolling?
We had a big breakthrough with one of the largest wireless carrier, mobile carriers in the U.S. They came back and said, totally, 100% get it. They see this fragmentation between the different screens because they were a part of creating that problem, so to say, because they're pushing out tablets and pushing out phones. So they came back and said, I totally get it. Let's do a big... And I think the initial commitment to them was like $500,000. Like, it's a huge... huge amount of money for a company like ours. And then when we got that big breakthrough, then it worked very well. Then it just kind of, we went from zero customers to a huge list. So
that was your big case study.
That was a big case study, and it was a big proof that we could work on the big advertisers. We had obviously worked with the three lists, and like we had worked with like tech companies and like all kinds of direct response type of companies to prove out that this works in the meantime when we got all those no's. But this was the first huge one where we could prove this on massive scale.
Because with direct, what do you call them, direct mail companies, these are people who you don't really have to sell them. You just have to hit their cost per lead or cost per acquisition, right?
Yeah, they don't care what's inside the box as long as it performs for them. So we could, through those, and it's they're very easy to get as customers, although a lot of these people actually turned us down as well.
Really?
But if you do enough sales calls, you get a big enough group there that you can figure out everything in technology. And then we went to the big leagues once it works.
I want to ask you about the way you've hired and the culture of the company, but there's one more thing I wanted to talk about since you brought it up a couple of times. Your past company, Thumbplay, got huge. Here's what I've got in front of me. I've got who wrote this article? This is All Things D, an article about the sale to Clear Channel of everything except for the ringtone business, and it basically says that the sale had to happen because the music subscription business wasn't working and Thumbplay had to give up on it. And it also says that at one point the ringtone business was $100 million and then it went down. What happened there? That when it started going down, what would happen to you? How did you take it?
That's when I was on the beach.
You were done.
I was out of the company for a while when that happened.
But you still had an ownership in the business, right?
No, absolutely. I'm still involved for sure. But I think so. A lot of that is kind of around the innovation that you need to have in a company. So when I was there, we built the company from zero to $100 million in business. But at the same time, you had the iPhone, this is before the iPhone. So you had the iPhone coming out and that really kind of changed the whole market. So with that, there's a lot of things that we could have done in terms of kind of structuring that business for that big new future around iPhones. It was a tough dealing with all the record labels and all the mobile operators. So it was a fabulous experience to build a $100 million business when I was there in 2.5 years. That's the first time CEO. And tons of learnings out of that, and also learning in terms of when to get out of the business. So it was good. But now it's you kind of coming back and applying a lot of those things that you learned the second time around, and especially around teams and innovation and building things that are truly protectable over a long period of time and all these
because
things.
Because with Thumbplay, you can sell ringtones directly to consumers back with the old telephones. Old Motorola phones would allow people to go buy a ringtone online and put it on their phone and enjoy it. once the iPhone came out, you couldn't do that anymore. And so that opportunity was starting to close. But you saw other opportunities like selling music subscription services the way that Spotify does. You just weren't able to move to that the way that Spotify did.
Yeah, the challenge with that was really the Spotify still has that problem, is that the economics just are very tough when you have a record label involved. In the older business, the cost for the goods was much lower. Once we pushed really hard, and this was way before Spotify was in the US, around this unlimited access to music on all your devices, mm-hmm. and the product was fabulous. But getting this economics to work, when the label takes 40% of it, and the carriers take 40%, and there's a bunch of artists that take a big percentage of it as well, it's very tough. And to make that work as a business, it works. We got the profitability, and it worked. Worked as a company, but getting into some massive billion-dollar companies with huge profits in that business is just brutal.
I can see. The big takeaway that this author of the All Things D article said was, it's a cautionary tale for investors pouring money into digital music, and that's a big issue.
Makes you famous but not rich.
So did you become paranoid after that? That you hit such phenomenal heights, and then one thing could go wrong, meaning the industry that you're in is not a very generous one to be in, and everything could start to fall apart. Did you become paranoid?
No, not really. I think you just learn to focus on, in the first companies I did, I was very top line focused, things that can build big top line. That's where kind of these came into place, where saying, oh, you have to actually look on the bottom of the page as well, because that's more interesting. That's where the bottom line of the company and the long-term sustainability of a company is really around how much cash it can throw off. So that's where those three things came from in terms of the filters, the scalability, and that can really protect this over time. And that when you do those two things, that it becomes a profitable company, because we become the largest one in the space. But at the same time, we started kind of breaking even around $100-$120 million in revenue, and that's very hard for any company to get to those revenue streams.
That less than $100 million, you're not breaking even.
Yeah, which is tough. So there's not many entrepreneurs that build $100 million businesses. It's harder. But we want to make sure that when you actually get to that level, that you succeed, you can actually then start to generate some real profits, and you have an IPO option than just as kind of as a sale option when you start generating bottom line money.
I see. So you're hiring incredibly quickly, I'm imagining, with this with the growth as it is at Taphad. What is your growth rate for hiring right now?
Yeah, now we were five people then for those months, and then we went from five to now 70 people in the next 22 months. So, and even in kind of in the last 15 days, I think we've hired 15 people. So so now we are on this tremendous growth rate and building out offices outside of New York. We opened up 8 offices outside of New York in the last 12 months.
So you can't keep flying to Norway and bringing back top talent from there and finding them all girlfriends. How do you find people now?
I have 2 internal recruiters that work full time on only that. We have 4 or 5 firms that only do work on this for us as well. Challenge though is that I've been kind of interviewing 30 people for every one person that I'm hiring. That ratio is now probably down to 1 to 10, but it's still, if you can bring 70 people in with 1 to 30 ratio, that's 2,100 people that you need to talk to. So you have to have a tremendous amount of just people going through the system and dedicate time to it. But now when you have done that and handpicked 70 people, then it rolls by itself, because one good person always brings one other good person in. One bad person is you -5, because they are able to hire 1 or 2 bad people before you figure out what's going on, and they also piss off a couple of the people, other people in the office that leave. So if you do a couple of these bad hires, you -5. If you do a good hire, you +1. So
what do you guys do for hiring that other people don't, that gives you an advantage?
think we focus a lot around these core values, what we're looking for. So we have these 10 articles in our constitution around what we're looking for in people and what the, kind of the values and the culture of the company. Those things are very important for us in terms of scaling the company. And it also attracts the right people, because when they walk in the door, they will see these 10 articles written there, and everybody in the company signed off on them, and they can read them and say, hey, this doesn't fit for me. I'm not a hard worker. I'm not a big thinker. I'm not a so they can then turn and leave before they can.
You guys have a constitution like the U.S. It says things like maintain maniacal focus on dominating one thing, use technology to innovate, fight like the underdog, break the rules, define new rules, make them play by our rules. Speak up about the good, the bad, and the ugly. Do you have a situation where your CTO did that?
Yeah, all the time.
What's an example of him speaking up about the good, the bad, or actually, from what I see in my notes here, the ugly?
Let's see.
Something about how no one was buying. Here it is. Our head of sales came to me and told us about problems customers are really having. And then he went to the CTO and they said that they really want to buy, but they don't have our authorization to buy. I guess this was in the period where people couldn't buy more than just the one kind of product that they were doing.
Yeah.
That they really want just mobile now. Oh, I see. So that was the ugly, that he said, hey, I know you are in. I know this whole vision here is to sell to everything, to sell people on all the devices, but all they really want to buy is mobile now. That's an ugly truth, but we have to accept it.
Yeah, and that made us change our approach with your what you just mentioned earlier around the Trojan horse ID. So we knew where we wanted to be, but we had to adjust this then after that. But if we didn't have this culture of people actually talking about the ugly things and talking about the bad things and kind of putting everything under the carpet and hope that you never find it, if we didn't have this culture from the beginning, we would never have gotten that information, never learned about it, and then we couldn't take the action and do something about it. So that's very important for us as it grows, especially when we have this tremendous growth rate that we see now, both on revenue and people and all that, is that nobody wants to be the one that turns on the light of the party. They don't want to be the one that tells that things actually don't work or things are not good and we need to do something else, or we hire the wrong person, or like all these things that happens in every startup. But now we have the culture of getting that out in the open and dissent with others if you don't agree with them. And then we can discuss it and we can figure the solution, but kind of get the ugly out in the open and so we can deal with it.
And so now I've got a note here to come back and ask you about the tough periods. And I think it's important to ask about that because so far, Ari, it seems like this is a charmed life. You came up with an idea in the room by yourself. You checked it with one of the top people in the ad space. Everything worked out. Yeah, you had a little bit of difficulty selling, but it all worked out. Now you're on the road to this billion-dollar business. But it couldn't have been that easy. What was the toughest period for you?
The toughest period was like after we were two tough periods. One was the period when we thought we were going to, when I said that I didn't want to do a company that we can build in 2 weekends, I was more thinking, okay, well, let's do something we can build in 3 to 6 months, right? But as we went, we were on the 9 to 12 months and still haven't really had a breakthrough around the technology here, that was pretty tough because you're kind of up against the clock there, and you're not able to solve the problem, and you're trying it from every angle, and at that point as well, it's building companies are so hard because it's sort of kind of moving targets everywhere, and you don't have anything that is solid, so you're kind of standing on all these things that keep moving underneath you. So in that period when we couldn't really nail down the technology, once we nailed down the technology, then I knew what sales team to build, what products to build, what everything else, but when we couldn't stand on one thing in the beginning there, it was very tough to kind of figure out where to go. So that was the first kind of dark period. Second dark period was when we then thought we had this huge breakthrough and we come out to market with a solution and nobody was buying it.
Why didn't you give up at that point? Why didn't you say, hey, this idea is just not going to make sense. It's time to move on. I have 25 other ideas on post-it notes on the wall.
Good question. I think you get so stubborn as an entrepreneur that and I've done it before and seen it before as well. So I know that things are not they don't just work immediately. Things that work immediately are too easy. So I think that was the background. And it was just that let's keep banging our head in the wall here until this wall breaks down. I don't know how long we're going to do it and how thick this wall is, but let's keep on doing it, because I knew we were onto something big, especially when we got it to work. Then I knew we were onto something big. And at that point, we were more kind of trying to figure out what the waiting for the market and the structures and everything left to turn around. And that's something that I can sit around and wait for, because I knew also that all the education that we put into talking to our customers about this in that period is now paying off huge, because once we've got this first wireless carrier and we went from zero customer to now we work with 140 of the largest brands in the US, signing up 2-3 of them a week. But that is happening because we put almost a full year of education into the market.
I see. So where someone else might say, hey, no one's buying from me, this is an indication that my idea doesn't work, you thought, no, no one's buying from me, this is part of the process. It's not because I'm a terrible salesperson. It's not because my idea doesn't work. It's just part of the process. You don't close every sale right away.
Yeah, it wasn't. That was also. You also get a lot of doubt at that point, right? You get on. You feel that you have a solution, but then you have the entire market against you. Everybody, there's nobody that's kind of helping out and saying, "Oh, that's such a great idea." And but you have everybody against you, and at that point as well. And it's tough to then motivate the team to keep going and that part of it as well. So, and that's where you also filter out all the ones in the team that don't have the same kind of conviction about the idea and about the team and about the technology. So it's a good way to kind of get rid of the riffraff. And then once it turns around, you have this really strong core of people, and that's when you explode out of that and you scale huge. So
let me do a quick thank you, and then I want to ask you about something from your childhood that I couldn't believe when I read this. The thank you is to Mixergy premium members. I know I keep talking about what you get as a premium member, but I have to just thank you and acknowledge what I get when you're a premium member. You're the reasons why we're able to continue to do interviews that are serious interviews, where I can come in with heavy research, with prep, and with a focus on what's important and not just on what's going to drive more traffic. Frankly, if this was just... if it wasn't for the premium members, then I wouldn't be able to put all this on. I wouldn't be able to do this interview with a focus that probably will appeal to, I don't know how many people in the world care that much about business that they're willing to sit through an hour. And those that do, I don't think most of them care about the real part of business. They just want to know about the cars, the Lamborghinis, the days off, and all the money that you make from it. And it's a rare group of people who say, no, tell me about the hard work. Tell me about where the idea came from. Pause for a moment and really dive deep into every part of the ideation process. And I appreciate that you guys are there and that you're a part of Mixergy Premium. So thank you for doing that. And if you guys are listening, if someone out there is listening and hasn't joined and wants to join, just go to MixergyPremium.com. So here's the interesting thing. You built something out. You were big on Lego and building as a kid. And you built something for your mom as a kid. Do you remember what I'm talking about when you were about 8-9 years old?
Yeah, it was the best business I ever built, because it had 100% margins. It didn't have the sustainability that I wanted, but the I noticed there was a lot of traffic into my room. So what I ended up doing was building. If you remember the Lego had the motors, so I built this automatic door opener that you had to put a quarter in for the door to open. So it's a perfect business because 100% margins, and you build it once and it will make money forever.
Charging your mom to come into the room?
Yeah, so my charge mom to clean my clothes. So that was the part of it I didn't kind of fully think through as an 8-year-old. My mom was in the beginning, oh, this is so cute, oh my God, it's so entrepreneurial, this is great, I'm happy to put a quarter in. But after 2 weeks, she was, I'm not paying more to clean his clothes.
So it's interesting that she was encouraging of it. She didn't say, why do you charge? Charging is evil. It's, hey, this is a cute idea, you're entrepreneurial, and it's a creative expression of that entrepreneurial bent.
Weeks until she said, I'm not paying to pay this guy to wash this guy's clothes.
And then
just popping up outside of the door.
Because apparently you upgraded. You went on to, did you build cars later on?
I did, yeah. I built bikes after that. So I built bikes, found like spare parts of bikes, and cost maybe $5 to find and get the parts, and then you sold it for $200. Painted it a little bit and sold it for $200. So that was also a high margin business. And then I went into cars, did the same thing with cars. So we bought them from one part of the country, fixed them up a little bit, and then drove them to another part of the country and sold them there for twice as much. So,
Is it fair for me to think that part of the reason you were able to do that and then do thumb play and now do tap pad is because your mom didn't say, I can't believe you're doing this when you built the toll with the electric door opener, but she encouraged you?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it is in what your parents kind of encouraged you to do. They did that with everything, not only for entrepreneurial. They were just giving me a kind of liberal upbringing, kind of try whatever you want, and we're not going to stop you and direct you and put you into becoming a lawyer or a doctor or any of things like that. They just kind of let me do what I wanted to do, and that turned into wanting to build companies and build teams and build big businesses.
All right, well, thank you so much for sharing the story of how you built these businesses. For anyone who's listening, the company is TapAd, and it's just TAPAD.com. And of course, it's a grown company, so I'm sure that there it is, careers right at the top. That's one of the cool things about being a part of a fast-growing company, that you get to watch it grow, but also you guys are open to hiring, and it's right there at the top. Thank you so much for sharing the story of how you built your business.
Great. Thanks so much for doing this.
Well, thank you all for being a part of it.
Thank you.